Response, but can the honourable members note that there is one official that's going to leave us because she has a child that is admitted at a hospital. So her flight is at 4, she needs to be there when the child is admitted. So I've excused her. When the time is appropriate, she will leave us. So we don't want you to think that she's being disrespectful when she does that. She has to catch this flight back to Johannesburg. I think my last one is on the Liberation Heritage Road. The department seems to be budgeting for the Liberation Heritage Road here, but in my own understanding, the National Heritage Council is dealing with the issue of the National Liberation Road. And I find that there's a duplication of some sort. If you can also touch on that when you are responding. The floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Perhaps I would start with the issue of consultants. From the part of the irregular expenditure relates to consultants in terms of not appropriate processes followed to appoint them, and also with certain renewals where there's been no basis for such renewals. To this end, the minister is putting in place a process of putting in a forensic investigation to look at the irregular expenditure. Now, firstly, to be able to see the cost, even where the consultant's contracts have expired, to be able to evaluate, has there been value for money for those services that were rendered. So the evaluation of the deliverables will be looked into. But also with those that have contracts that are currently in place, to be able to look at how do we reduce the reliance and be able to then make sure that we can be able to build capacity. So the process of a forensic investigation is taking place that would then delve deeply into the issues, but also to say what are the mechanisms that will be then in place should there be adverse results. In terms of if there's not been value for money, what are then the appropriate measures that would then need to be taken? So the investigation will help answer those questions. So we cannot then be able to delve further until we have that investigation that is then based on facts and with evidence supporting it. Then we should be able to act on those findings. However, with the current costs that are being incurred, we also would be instituting measures to, in line with the prescript of National Treasury, to actually decrease, even though there's contracts, we then have to look at still, what is the value for money? Is there duplication within the department? And if there is, then look at, through the contractual obligations, how do we get out of those? And so there is that parallel process. And looking at some of the programs, such as the Honorable Mahlangu, Member Mahlangu raised, for example, what are we doing with the sourcing enterprise? So effectively, with the sourcing enterprise, we've changed the name to be the Mzansi Golden Market, which is a platform whereby goods and services for that are consumed by both government and the private sector can be sourced through this portal. So if I'm an artist and I have let's say I'm a musician and the government has a launch where they require musical artists to be able to perform, they can use the Mzansi Golden Market, and formerly known as the e-sourcing. And so this has been amplified with the minister's budget vote to saying we can use this as a base to be able to create access to markets. Because you see, when you are able to consolidate the spend of government, which can be quite immense, you can actually be able to then utilize that to empower artists, whether it's for crafts. So for example, if we have gifts that are given by the private sector at the end of the year, they could use through this Mzansi Golden Market to use it to source what kind of gifts can they be able to give to their clients. And so by consolidating this, we can then hopefully be able to measure the impact that art and culture is having. And so you can even scale it up to look at how do you utilize it to increase the audiences, and whereby you could have a loyalty program using the same platforms. So for example, you can have a Mzansi Golden Economy Card for our entities. If you come for a market theatre or state theatre, you are able to utilize this card either to get a discount or to be able to get benefits through our events or through the entities within the department. So the importance of such is such that it provides us with a base so that we can be able to have sustainable economic development. And Nakisa, the idea behind it, is to be able to create and help skills, build the skills. For example, there are technical skills that may be lacking, and so that could be addressed through the Nakisa program. But also, the skills, you might find that the artists have good technical skills, but they don't have business skills because they are running enterprises.
I think as we are looking at this particular report, I think it would assist us if you say, for instance, Nakisa have done this, not who would do this, because this is after the effect.
Sure.
Yeah, no? Yeah. I think it's important for us to, for the purposes of the annual report, when you address us to say it has been done or it has not been done. Because if we talk about the future, we are coming to the future. Sometime, maybe next week or the other week, we'll come to the future. But now we are focusing on this 3 million right here. Did Nakisa do what they were supposed to do with the 3 million? This 9 million, did insourcing or whatever it is, did they do what they were supposed to do? Then we'll come to the future, because the future is very important, but basing it on what has happened now in this particular annual report, because it talks about things that have happened already. It's not talking about what we are. So I think it would assist us if you say the 3 million that is here, Nakisa was given, they did what they were supposed to do, or they did not, and then we are looking at something else, then we'll talk about something else later.
Okay. Thank you, Chair, for that clarity and direction. And so in terms of my colleague Monica would give detail on the actual performance or deliverables that is supporting the amounts of the consultants. So to close up on the consultants before giving over to my colleague is that there is a tangible action plan through the forensic audit to be able to determine value for money, but also to be able going forward now, how do we decrease reliance on consultants, and there is tangible steps that we're taking with regards to that. And perhaps Monica can take us through some of the underlying deliverables from the current consultants.
Yes. It would be important for us to get the program, that program that you're having, to say this is what we are going to do and this are the timeline, so that we are able to monitor and see that you are doing what you said you are going to do. Because we were here with the Auditor General this morning, and we signed a contract with them that you are going to ensure that what you say you are going to do, you are going to do. But if you don't, then we'll see about that. But I think it's important we take your words when you say this is what we are going to do as a department to respond to the problem. But give us that program so that we can monitor you, so that we can be able to say, okay, this is what they said they are going to do. They are doing it or they are not doing it. Because I know every year government departments say they are going to do the same thing every year, what was mentioned by one of the members here, that you say the same thing every year, but sometimes things don't happen. So if you give us the program to say, okay, this is what we are going to do, these are the timelines, and the forensic audit, it's going to take this long, and you know, whatever. So that, but we must be in a position as the committee to monitor and evaluate you as you go forward.
Thank you, Chairperson. And I think to build on what Honorable Mahlangu has mentioned in terms of the management letter, so what we've done is we've articulated all the key findings and been able to say these are the core causes of these findings, and we have action plans, and there will be also responsibilities allocated, and therefore we can be able to also have deadlines that would bring the DDGs accountable as well as myself as the accounting officer accountable. And the monitoring aspect of that would also be done through the audit committee, which we'll address as well later on. So we would welcome an engagement on that plan and be able to be using as a template to be measured in terms of the progress being made in dealing with some of those items.
Honourable Member, Honourable Fulbong had also asked to leave earlier because he's catching a flight. I'm sorry I didn't say that while he was in. He's not being disrespectful. He's interested in the work that we are doing, but he has a flying ticket. Thank you.
If I just may repeat what I said this morning, I think that microphone that does not work. If the light goes on, but we can't really hear it, if you don't mind. And while I've got the microphone, I've also got a flight later on. I'll stay as long as I can, if you don't mind. Thank you.
Thank you, and my apologies, members, for the earlier comments that may have been in the room. With regard to the sourcing enterprise and Zambia Golden Market, as it's now known, this year's target was essentially to set up the portal. So in other words, to do the work to basically do the systems architecture that would create the web-oriented portal. We recognize that we did not have the skills to do this in-house, so through an open tender process, we sourced in a company called Bitech to do the work for us, and their objective was to design and develop a portal and to essentially have a pilot running, which was in fact duly successfully received. So in essence, that project was successfully delivered, and I think it's just important to note that the tables as we see them on pages 92 and 93 are an amalgam of both consultants appointed in-house to support skill deficits in the department, but also service providers that essentially have been appointed through tender processes to run actual projects for the department. So I think it's important to create that distinction. With regard to Nakisa, it's a very, very large project with a very, very wide scope of view. And one of the complexities of this has been the concept. The notion in its initial phases was essentially to establish a physical institute that would be both at primary, high school, and tertiary level with ancillary facilities like a theatre and a gallery. And as a result, that's the concept that the consultant was working on. That notion has sort of shifted primarily due to sentiment and in some respects practicality to begin to think more about the Nakisa concept in terms of how can it work with the existing service providers and very good nonprofits that work in our sector. The service provider's contract has come to an end and is no longer working on the project. Unfortunately, the Nakisa deliverables were not achieved in the year under review. Thank you.
We're not actually.
And looking at the human resources issues, in terms of the performance management system that the Honourable Member raised, the concern about, you know, not it effectively the department not working with the mandate. And so I would like to get Conrad to deal with those aspects.
Honourable Chairperson and members, thank you, Acting DG. There were a couple of issues around performance agreements. Why have some of the members not, senior management members, not entered into agreements? And what will we do to ensure compliance in future? Now, on on page 81 of the annual report, we have an indication of the level of compliance. Signing of performance agreements by senior managers, SMS members by 31 May 2013. Now, there is a regulatory requirement that all senior managers enter into agreements by the 31st of May, failing which there is non-compliance. And what we've indicated in this table is actually the level of compliance as at the 31st of May. However, from HR side, from human resource unit side, we have consistently been requiring of senior managers to actually comply. And I can report that the majority of senior management members have actually complied at the end, even though they didn't meet the deadline. There are also some explanations in the annual report as to why some, like for instance, there was one senior manager who was on a prolonged sick leave. There were a couple of new appointments where, in terms of the regulations, new SMS members have a period of 3 months to actually get into a performance agreement after the date of appointment. I can maybe state to the committee as well that this is, probably not a standing item, but it's a matter that is being tracked on an ongoing basis by the audit committee, on how many senior managers do actually enter into performance agreements. And we have also undertaken to require of the managers to those employees who do not meet the requirement to actually take disciplinary action against them. It has not been necessary in the previous year to do that because there were what can be regarded as valid reasons as to why senior managers are not. But it is quite a headache for us. And I always have an issue with my colleagues when we draw up the APP. One of our targets that we have to meet is 100% compliance, which is one of my targets as HR, but yet I'm dependent on other managers actually contracting. And I want to see at the end of this financial year, in any case, that all senior managers have met this requirement.
When a manager or any official does not have not signed a performance contract, what are you paying this person? Why are you paying that person at the end of the month? Because that person is doing whatever he or she wants to do. And, you know, there's nothing that's binding the person to say, this is what we are paying you to do this way. So on what basis do you pay the officials that have not signed the contract?
I think, it's probably a legal labor matter. What I can say is that there is let's call it a punitive measure for employees who do not enter into performance agreements by the set deadline. And that is that they will not qualify for any performance incentives, be it the normal pay progression, which is moving from one notch to the other financial year, or then any other performance. I'm not sure what the implication will be if we had to say, well, I'm not going to pay your salary at the end of the month if you don't enter into agreement. I can ensure the committee that there will be 100% compliance, but I also think that there will be some legal issues that we probably need to consider. But from HR's point of view, we will welcome such strict measures to be applied, because at least then there will be 100% compliance. Then there was just a general, I think it was a comment or a question as well on how can we not have a performance management system. And we actually do have, we have two different performance management systems. One for levels 1 to 12, which is a system that is currently in place, it's working very well. Then there's the, sorry?
From level 1, the level that is taken up of those ones signed because they want money, that's incentive. So the upper one doesn't care because the salary is fed.
Yeah, and I must say we've actually, even this year, and we'll probably report it in our next report, but we've also been struggling to actually implement that performance management system or the outcome of that through the performance incentives. We, in previous years, we were always very late. We only managed to finalize it in November, December, and in this year we managed to finalize it at the end of August, which has already been quite an achievement for us, thinking that we implementing or processing close to 400 assessments of individual employees. Then with regard to the SMS, the Senior Management Performance Management System, that is regulated by the Senior Management Service Handbook. And as I've said, we managed to increase the level of compliance, but there are still those managers who do not meet the entering by the deadline, and then also the processing of assessments, which we've not done for the previous year yet. But what I can assure the committee is that we do have these systems. There's probably a need here and there to tweak the system and review it. Our challenge, however, is that within our competency as the department and being a user of a national system, the Department of Public Service and Administration are actually the ones that, through the bargaining councils, then consult with organized labor to make significant changes. But we have been trying to streamline this system to the best of our ability, and I do think that it is working fairly well. Chair, I think that deals with the issues of performance management. I'm not sure, Acting DG, whether I should talk about the filling of posts and should I? With regard to the filling of strategic posts, and it was a finding by the Auditor General, and I think they were specifically emphasizing our Chief Financial Officer, which has been vacant for a very long period. I think it's probably about 4 years. And I think we have in previous meetings as well been trying to explain the challenges that we've had. At one point, at the end of last year, 2013, we had cabinet approval for the appointment of a CFO, and unfortunately, right towards the end, or as she was about to assume duty, she declined the position. However, I can report that the current minister has decided that we re-advertise the post of Chief Financial Officer, as well as the DDG for corporate services. Both these posts were advertised in August. We had to unfortunately extend the running time because of the challenges that we had with the post office. We had a lot of candidates submitted their applications via the post office, and because of the strike action, those did not reach us, so we had to reopen it. But I can also report that we have done our initial screening, and that the minister has on a number of occasions indicated to us in meetings that we really need to prioritize this. So I'm hoping that before we break for Christmas this year, that we can then report that we have a Chief Financial Officer as well as a DDG Corporate Services. Both these positions have to go to cabinet route for approval. Chief, there's a question number.
I just want to find out what will happen if then the post office strike is not resolved soon. Will it be deferred again or what?
Thank you, Anna.
Chair, what we realized is that we did not receive any applications when we advertised it in the open media, where we said to people they should submit their applications via either post or hand delivery. We then put an additional notice in the newspaper where we said those candidates who submitted their applications via the post office should please scan and email them to us, or then alternatively hand deliver, which we have then received quite a number of additional ones. So we will take account of any future positions. I think, let me first of all say, I think we're quite confident that all the applications that should have reached us, either via the post office or via hand delivery, are now in the possession of the department because of this additional initiative that we reopened it. But we'll also be sensitive in future cases where we advertise that we actually allow people and or actually discourage them to use the post office while the strike action is in place. So I think we are aware of the implications there. Then there are a number of other key senior management positions that are also in the process of being finalized. For instance, our director legal services, there's a director social cohesion, there are other couple of posts as well, chief director cultural development, chief director national archives, which are also now in the process of basically shortlisting interviews and even some of them awaiting the final approval for the appointment. So, and this will naturally, I think, I don't want to misquote the annual report, but I think we have a vacancy rate of around 13% in as far as senior management posts are concerned. And with the appointments or the filling of these posts, that vacancy rate will be naturally decrease. Well, probably stepped on the issue of the consultants, but there was one question around who is the person in New York that is a consultant. And with the... Yes, and in other countries as well. As Monica has indicated on page 93, I think there's a list table 4.5, page 92, table 4.55, there is a list of all the consultants. And there is reference to the SA UK cultural seasons and the SA French cultural seasons. Now, with the introduction of these cultural seasons, probably about 2 years ago, the need arose for representatives of South Africa to be present in those countries who will, what we refer to as country coordinators, who will really be representing us in those countries. And these are the people that have then been appointed under the mandate of the department, and they have been working directly with our international relations units. Now, the ideal situation with a program such as the Cultural Seasons is to actually have cultural attachés deployed through through DIRCO and the embassies then in those countries who will then be representing us. And we actually are busy with the process to look at our what we refer to as our cultural diplomacy framework, which will involve the appointment or assignment of cultural attachés to these countries. But because of the fact that these programs are, well, have been running and there was an urgent need and the magnitude of establishing this cultural diplomacy unit within the department and then the deployment of cultural attachés, that these people were then, well, what we refer to, we can't call them attachés, but cultural coordinators then who represented the department and assisted the department in
There's a follow-up question, and I advise that if there are, because this responses, if there are any follow-up questions, you ask immediately, because we won't have another round. I think I would advise that. Honorable Mahlangu.
Well, the response to the question is, I don't know, but it appeared to be a very dangerous route. Having a person operating parallel to the established international consuls. I mean, you've got telco that is responsible, and everyone that performs in that field would definitely be embedded into that system. And we are creating a parallel international relations forum, which is terrible. But secondly, the question that I'd like to raise, are these guys, or these people, South Africans, or we just pick up people elsewhere and so they do the job? I mean, there's just too many questions that comes with the answer, and I think it's just a very scary situation. But yeah, who are they? Are they South Africans? But you see, the response, Chair, spoke to UK and France, but you raised an issue of US. So the answer that is here on the paper does not speak to what the Chair is raising.
And my follow-up on this is that are these people in our organogram, are they in our organizational structure? Or how would we know that there are these people as the portfolio committee if we don't hear from people who are out there? How would we know that there are people that are being paid with taxpayers' money from South Africa in another country? And looking at what Honorable Mahlam was saying, I think we need to get this information. And if this is one of the things that came out in our strategic planning session, where we were saying that what happens if officials in the department don't give us all the information? What happens? Because this is what sometimes happens. We are being given that information that's suitable for us. And I think it's very dangerous, because sometimes you are like teachers, we ask you something that we know, because that's what teachers do. They ask you, they know the answer. So when you respond to our questions, know that sometimes we have the answers already. Well, I just want to hear what you are going to say. The answer is with us already. So I think it's important for you when you are responding. We are like teachers. We ask what we know sometimes. So I think it's important for you to give us honestly and openly the information so that we see how we deal with things together. Because as we have said from the beginning, that as the portfolio committee, yes, our mandate is oversight, but we want to assist the department to do the right thing for the benefit of the community. So give us the information.
Now, Chairperson, I think the department needs to empower us. We are new. Can we get the copy of the organizational structure, including those who are in another countries, if they are there? And can we get the authentic one, the one that the treasurer, the one that is inside? Please, because you know why, Chairperson, if that structure is not here, or the structure is not there in the department, we are running another person here. Please, because we don't want to see what is happening in person, where we are having 49 deputy directors that the department doesn't know about them, with maybe 4 general workers. Can we get that structure? And I don't think it will take time or 7 days. I think they're having it in their laptops or whatever. They can even send it now to us so that we check it. Thank you.
Thank you. Gee, we will definitely make available the organizational structure, but just to, there was a follow-up question of are these people on our structure now? Because they're not employees, and as indicated in our report, consultants are not employed against our organizational structure. And then whether they are South African or not is with the French as well as the UK season. These are people that are South African. Some of them are based in those countries. I also know that in China, I think there's also a person who's...
So the department is not paying these people. These people are paid by consultants.
through our goods and services budget as consultants.
What you are saying is that you give consultants A 1.5 million and they are the consultants A. Consultants A is the one who pays the people. It's not directly from us paying this person. You give it to a consultant and the consultant pays the attaché.
Understand it. They have these individuals, they are consultants, they are doing the work, whatever work it is, the 365 days that they work in UK, in London, in China. Those are consultants, they are individuals who are receiving money from DEC.
Okay. So this money, this 1 point, whatever, rent, is given to me as a consultancy firm. So there is no... can you...
I think Mimu Mashangu is 100% correct. We contract individuals as consultants. Then there's a service level agreement between the department and that individual with certain deliverables and even when they do their claims, they attach reports. So it's an individual that is contracted and we pay the individual in their personal capacity.
I need empowerment here. The department, you said there are service, there are consultants. I just wanted to know the contractors that are in Perusal, what is the difference between them and the ones that the department can take and put them in a person? Why these ones are not in a person? And the worst part, they're in another foreign country. In terms of labor law, how do you manage that? Because now they are consultants. So on the issue of monitoring, who's giving the oversight? Chairperson, we are throwing the money into the dustbin. Guys, this is bad. Because in terms of the seven level agreement, which one are they using? Are they using the departmental one or are they using their own? Especially on the labor laws, how are you dealing with it? What if maybe these consultants, wherever they are, they hire other people and on the issue of labor, they are not dealing with people or their employees in a well manner? Don't you think that you are putting South African government in a very, very serious deep end? I'm from Kosad before I came here. This is a shocking story, really. Really. Because this is a, maybe call it international labor brokering now. I thought it's only in South Africa. Now it even went back to the Margaret Thatcher's one, the privatization. Imagine, why can't they be contracted inside the country in a person? I was a public servant. I know that there are people that are in contract that are in a person. So maybe the department really needs to explain to us how does this thing happen? And for how long is this thing has been going on? We just put in a lot of money going that side. For the people, and why these countries? Honorable Mashangu earlier talked about Africa. I'm an African. Why are we contracting all our things go international? In sub-Saharan Africa, there's nothing that the department sees or draw to build the issue of agriculture. Why it must go to France or UK? We are having our brothers in the nearby countries. We can go to Zimbabwe, Lesotho, anywhere. But why only UK and France? And what France all is all about? I think we need to check this, Chairperson. You know, I understand why Honorable Mashangu was very hard on intent of this international seasoning thing. I can't go to China. Okay, we do have the relations. But where's Africa in this thing? Maybe you don't even have one country that the department has contracted in Africa. Thank you. What is the right?
Thank you, Honorable Member. Maybe you just explain it a bit so that we get clarity and then proceed to the next question.
Thank you. Just to clarify the issue about Pershal and consultants versus contractors. The majority of these consultants who we have contracted do appear on the partial system. Now, the only reason why we've done that is not, and they're not regarded as employees, they're regarded as what we call periodic workers. And the reason why we did that is in line with a tax directive by South African Revenue Service, there is a 25% tax that is deducted, and this is normally when people do not have VAT numbers and those types of things. We actually contract them with on an individual basis, and we appoint them onto the partial system so that we can actually implement that tax directive of the 25%.
To procure those services, you go through the regular procurement process.
No. With some of these was that single source appointment that the Auditor General identified as being irregular or not following procurement processes, but it was a single source appointment, and especially like if you can use the example of these South Africans that are abroad staying in other countries. By the way, they do have South African bank accounts, and that's actually how we pay them via the partial system. But those are the what are referred to as the single source appointments that the accounting officer then authorised.
Honourable Chair, sorry, can I come in here? This is part of what we need to investigate as part of the forensics in terms of those irregular expenditure incurred through the consultant. So we definitely, in terms of then making sure that we get to the bottom of the cause for the irregular expenditure, to be able to then answer some of the questions that Honourable Mahlangu has raised, in terms of yes, some of these consultants, like in the US, they're not South African citizens, and that's what we need to get into. And definitely, it's a concern from having parallel structures where we should be engaging with DERCO in terms of cultural attachés, and therefore having these parallel structures is not on. And so those are the things we are getting to the bottom of, and being able to also, where there's contracts, we need to be able to curtail as per the contracts. Some of the to end some of the contracts. So it is a matter that we are actively dealing with currently.
Just two last follow-ups. I will not come back on the matter. No, I think it will it will actually help us that we know as to who these people. I think it will help us as the oversight body that we get to know who they are, their profiles and everything, because South Africa is from time to time under attack from other people who are earning hugely from us, but who have no commitment to the cause. So I think as an oversight body, I would like us to get that information. And I'm stepping off that mat. But just as a follow-up, I don't know whether I should call it a follow-up chain. You see, and I'm making this an example, just out of concept. Look, on page 92, you've got this consultant of 121 days. Win Brone, turnaround project. But we've got Winpro as one of the worst entities. I mean, DAG is, I don't know what DAG is up to. I mean, these things don't make sense. And Nina, you are there. You are senior managers. Seriously qualified, confident about doing your responsibility. But these things happen under your noses, and you don't take action. someone also from outside must come from the AG and say, why do you continue to do this thing? And you dug your head, you dig your head in the sand, and it's business as usual. It cannot be right. It cannot be right. I mean, there was no need, if you were doing your job, that the minister comes in yesterday and appoint a forensic. It is wrong. It is wrong. It is wrong. It should not have happened when we have you as DDGs running that entity. I mean, the minister said that, like yesterday, he doesn't know what's happening. But this thing, I mean, exploded in his face, and he said, forensic. I am saying, Mina, what are your consciences saying about this thing? I don't want to say other things, because, but let's get the names. I will reserve my question until I get the names of these people and their profiles, and then let's get the commitment that we get the names of these people.
I'm hoping that you are noting this issue, the things that you would like to get more information.
I forgot one last matter. The 365 days. I, as a consultant who issues an invoice, you are the only people who qualify for 365 plus a leave. And it's paid for, it's well declared. How do I charge you, whatever, invoice you for 365 days and you pay it gladly?
Thanks. You know, it's a chair. It's not very interesting when you have got senior government officials who behave like this just in front of the portfolio committee. Of course, we understand that for the new to be born, the old must die. But the old will not just give it easily, will fight. Chair, I raised these things of consultant earlier on, and I did not get any response. I said, how many consultants do this department has, and what are they doing? That question was not responded to. Chair raised an issue with a consultant who is in U.S. It's not here. But you all know that there's a consultant in U.S. What is it that consultant was doing there and was paid? I think it was 250 for some few days. You know. So will they respond to our questions, Chair, so that this meeting could follow?
Thank you very much, Honorable Member. Can we proceed to the responses?
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. We will provide the list as requested by the members, highlighting what the profile and the responsibility of these consultants and what they're getting paid to be able to address the issues raised by honourable members. To clarify, on page 92, 365, effectively, when you look at the heading, it says work days, but what it actually refers to is the 365 is the duration of the contract which applies to these contractors. Mm-hmm. So effectively with the 365 days, that would mean that it's a year's contract. And with a 306 being, and so forth, 11 months, 10 months or so. So it effectively refers to the duration of the contracts rather than the actual number of days that are worked, because the contracts do. Yes, And I guess that's the issue around the templates that utilize from Treasury. So effectively, instead of reflecting the work days, it reflected the duration of the contract. That's where the confusion arises.
Yeah.
And then with it,
referring to the working days, I'm sure you would have less than 365.
Absolutely.
Which is minus your weekends and your holidays.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
I think this is the issue that Honourable must. If you are specifically talking about
working
days,
yes.
The working days, then you should have something that's less than the working year.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because if you say 365 days, that's misinformation.
Absolutely, from an oversight on our side, to instead of using the actual work days, terms of the actual hours claimed, it's used the contractual duration rather than the actual actual days.
It then goes to the point that Honourable Mahlang was raising, that if you are saying 365 days, it means you are paying those people even for going to church. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what it says. You are paying the people for going to church.
Sure.
So as you are saying that you've taken note of that.
Sure. And also the clarity on 93 on table 4.56 where it shows how...
And maybe the issue that the some consultants that I hear on page 92,
yes.
The issue that is being raised by the Honourable Member is that there is a consultant that is in New York that's not appearing here. Or is it appearing somewhere here? And the one in China, do they appear here? Because if we say consultants and we say go to page 92, the information in page 92 is not giving us all the information.
Yeah.
Oh.
But in addition, Chair, when the acting DG, DG, it's saying DDG. Acting DG. Okay. It's saying they are contracted for 365 days. There's the one here, number one, in Madon. Still on site. How do you explain that acting DG?
I'm not sure I get the question. No. So we're saying with the legacy project that they're still on site.
Yes. The one, the Matola, your Matola raid.
Mm-hmm.
The consultant is still on site.
Chairperson, thank you. Maybe just to indicate that the consultant for Madonna is still in the department. And what happens, to respond also to Honourable Mahlangu, is that originally we had an arrangement with the Mozambican counterparts. In fact, they had promised that they were going to give us some of the stuff before the unveiling happened. But later on, we had to sort of look at our own resources. And then this person actually goes there, maybe to ensure that, you know, things are properly handled, and maybe he stays for three days there and come back to the department. He stays, is in the department, but from time to time goes to Madola just to see to it, even the work that is being finalized and is being taken care of. So he's still in the department.
The more you explain, it's more it becomes worse. The more you explain, Chairperson, sorry for coming in, but it actually becomes worse. Your information?
DJ, are you aware that the person is still on, the consultant is still working?
Perhaps can I address whether the work in terms of 100% done? In terms of when you look at the next page, when it says Matola raid, that refers to being HDI, whether the person is black in terms of from a BE perspective. So it's not the completion of the project. It's just indicating the demographic status of the person. So you would see, for example, with internal audit, it's 51.77. So there is a black ownership around it. It doesn't refer to the completeness of the project.
Is the project complete?
As far as I'm aware, no.
The entire structure is complete, and all that is actually outstanding now. It's the final text as well as the film, which is now, we're going to be viewing it on Thursday just to finalize the project. But they are just doing the final snagging in the project.
Okay. Maybe as the portfolio committee, we need to see this project. We need to see and verify the status of the project. Can you proceed with the responses?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. And the point raised by Honourable Mahlangu on the strategic overview in terms of taking into account the national treasury guidelines, looking at our mission and vision. It is quite a very important point that the Minister has also taken up to be able to make sure that the vision and mission of the department is actually reflective of the goal going forward. So it's a good point that we are currently working on in being able to take those prescripts into account and guidance into account. Then that would also help us when we then formulate the APPs to have concise targets that are smart in line with the vision. And so that's a work in progress. And there was also questions around the capacity of our internal audit and also the audit committee. Within the audit committee, they have exercised oversight, and they do have the acting chairperson, Mr. Mangeza, who is a chartered accountant. And in the financials, they also highlight the concerns that they've had with the department in terms of some of the constant things they've been raising. And they do meet regularly, and they've met about 6 times in the past year. And we are engaging them with taking through the management letter with the Auditor General. We're briefing them as well, and they're keeping exercising their oversight. However, when we look at our internal audit, we are not fully capacitated, and there was an outsourcing of functions where we used an external audit firm to help to do the internal audit. So what we're trying to do now is to make sure that we are having enough capacity and beefing up internal capacity while reducing reliance on the outsourcing. And the critical thing is to be able to make sure that we cover all the program, the internal audit work program, using internal capacity. So there is...
When you say that you don't have capacity in your internal audit, does it mean that you don't have enough people, or you have people who don't have capacity? Can you make it clear to the committee? What do you actually mean? Is the capacity with the number of people that are there, or is it the people are there, but they don't have the reasonable skill to do the work? What is it actually? Because when you say capacity, it's
sure.
A broad thing.
The chief audit executive has the capacity in terms of professional competence to be able to oversee the audit, internal audit plan. What we do not have is the people, the hands and feet to actually do the actual audits. And so we, through the budget reprioritization process, we are beefing up that unit to be able to employ people to be able to do the internal audit. Currently, we have the chief audit executive and two director deputy.
Chief thank you. We have the chief audit executive at director level, then we have two deputy directors. One deputy director audit, and we recently, about a month and a half ago, appointed a forensic audit deputy director, and then there's one PA. So all in all, there are four people, and as the acting DG has said, we do have a contract with a service provider, and what we want to do is to phase out the utilization. Like, for instance, the service provider has been assisting us with forensic investigations up to now, but with the appointment of this new deputy director, we are slowly but surely then phasing out and building the capacity internally.
Can you proceed with your response?
Regarding the supply chain management issues, I will defer to our acting CFO to respond.
Thank you, TG. Good afternoon, Chairperson and honorable members. In respect of supply chain, the problems are quite historical. Much as one has also assumed the acting role, you know, this financial year, I must state that with the audit of 2013-14 financial year, our non-compliance in terms of rent veil, that led to irregular had declined compared to last financial year, which was 12-13. 12-13, our irregular came to about 97 million compared to the audit that you got qualified for, which was 73 million. But if you add the two, obviously they will give a total of 171 million. But if you look at the AG's argument was largely on, you know, saying enough is enough, you know, so we have to clean up and make sure that you take a different direction as far as the non-compliance, because if they have not qualified us, we will find ourselves sitting at perhaps more than 300 million in the following financial year. So this approach of the AG, it was clear that the issues that we have, they've been there for a long time, the non-compliance part. The contributing factors has been largely on the skills around the skills around the SCM. There are people, there are bodies fully vacancies are actually filled, but there are lack of required skills and also the understanding of what needs to be regular in the department. Now, it's a bit difficult to explain because I also came 4 years ago, but those questions are already there. But it's something that I'll also mention, on my response. What the department is doing now to rectify the issues. The other part is also understanding from the from the management and as well as officials on what leads to irregular. The third one is also the issue of poor planning from the line function, that has led to a number of irregular that we have. So with those three, what
lack of planning, or is it done deliberately?
When I look at the irregular that we have, I tend to doubt that it's either or. Some of the things you will find that perhaps, like for example, the issues of quotation, you find that maybe they didn't give supply chain enough time to sort out quotation. So if you procure within 2-3 days, suppliers will not respond. and if they have to procure, they procure. They go ahead with one quotation. So those are just kind of examples similar with tender. So there could be a deviation on the tender process, but with reasons that are not justifiable when you read. So those are kind of irregular that we have, including the the non compliance with the SEM processes. Could be consultants, could be contractual agreements that are extended over a long period of time. But those are kind of irregular in nature. It's only on understanding what really leads to irregular, and also the issue of skill. You may have practitioners, but also if they have a register that is also not complete, AG will say, but this you filed is not in the register. So it's the application of the people as well that we have to identify actually the irregular. So on those three things that what we have attempted to do actually this year from April is to have two additional practitioners that are at least qualified, that will assist supply chain and finance.
Do you have those or have you created
the way? Yes, the way. But instead, we try to elevate in terms of the skill, to say maybe the person might have been, I'm making an example, a former AG employee, for example, that understands the system and internal audit experience than just a normal PESAL bus employee. So it's those kind of skills that were short, in the department. And also the workshop that we've done throughout the entire department, including some managers as well, on irregular policy, with referring to our nature, the type of irregular that we have, and also revising the SEM policy, which had gaps that AG also picked up, which led to a number of irregular as well that we have. What we also realized, and actually implemented is, okay, that we're going to be implementing is the consequent management, because it's been an issue that we've not addressed in the past. In terms of PFMA Section 38, it says that we need to prevent the irregular expenditure. And that's what we've been actually battling to do. We identify, we report irregular, and condone. So that is actually the gaps that we identified. But this time around, we are actually taking through that process. So in the event that one come across with irregular procurement, we take it back. We refer it back, be it a payment or a process, whether a submission or so. That's the approach that we're taking in terms of stopping the irregular payments. To date, we have irregular payment that is more contractual that you cannot move away from because they were irregular last year and they are contractual. So in that sense, the irregular that you carry on incurring every month is just those irregular. But apart from that, we don't have irregular. We're not going to be actually being the same boat as we were in the previous financial year. Once obviously the whole process of investigation, disciplinary process, condonation takes place, which as acting teacher indicated, it is taking place right now. And then we'll have to await Treasury to condone that.
Thank you. Are you able, as the department, to detect all your irregular expenditure? Or does AG come and identify irregular expenditure that you, as the department, have not detected?
Yes, Chairperson. We are able to. We are able to.
In the reports that were received, there is irregular expenditure that you did not detect as the department. That was only detected by AG. You don't remember anything of that sort?
Chairperson, the irregular debt AG was referring to was for last financial year, 13-14. And I can confidently say that in the role that one was playing wouldn't be able to prevent it, you know. But because the procurement happened through submission that goes through the CFO to the DG and so on. My role particularly has not been in that level. So now that one sees things pass through, if we pick up the procurement, because the payment is late, you've confirmed the service is going to be rendered, you have to pay it. You can't move out of that. But to prevent it is from the submission part where you request for a service and then we stop. So it's not a question of picking up what's already been paid, because that should be prevented, should not have happened from the first place. So we are able to prevent it such that there isn't a process that kicks in that is irregular. We shall be back so that managers and line function can comply. So that's what we're basically doing.
So Chairperson, just to amplify, as we speak today, in terms of the systems to detect irregular expenditure through the submission process, the controls are there today. Through the payment system, whether it's through sundry payments, the checks are there. The Auditor General is correct in the sense that when they did the test, now because they are looking at the financial year throughout, definitely there were some weaknesses in being able to identify fully. That is why they could not say they fully can be able to say it's complete on the register. But today, the instances on which irregular expenditure can be incurred is minimized. We are able to detect it and prevent it through the submission processes and through the payment processes.
Am I correct to assume that we are talking about 20% of the budget? That's what we are talking about. Google and Denisho, no, CFO.
So when you're
not talking about the complete budget of that you requested from Parliament.
Yeah. So it talks to the department's goods and services budget, but not the entire with the entity.
Yeah, Roger.
Yes.
According to the information that we received from AG, which we thought it's a bit scary, the fact that you cannot detect irregular expenditure when it comes, because you have to declare irregular expenditure to go to AG and say, hey, Smoshile, we've not complied here. And the Auditor General says, okay, then, but there is a big sum of money that was identified by Auditor General without the department having identified it. And it means that things are going through the department without, for instance, the Auditor General has made it clear here that in 2011-12, they have really given us this information that from 2012, how much was the irregular expenditure, and even there, they are showing how much the department could identify, how much was identified by them. That went through the department without the department even noticing. In 2013, it's the same thing. Do you have it? You have it, honourable members, from the document that we were given this morning by AG. Yeah. So I think it's an area that maybe with your intervention, the intervention that you've just said is in the department now, you can overcome this. But it's scary when the department would not detect irregularities. It's very scary. I'm doing the into labor. This department thing I have not. And it goes through, someone is being paid without following the right processes. It's here, it's in black and white. We were given the report this morning by the Auditor General. We'll share this information with you so that you look at these areas that are a bit scary to us who are not in the department. You can.
Chair, Honourable Masang raised a point of on the expenditure, we 94% spent on based on the appropriation, and while our target, we in terms of performance information, is 71%. So there is no direct correlation in terms of the expenditure and the performance information in terms of achieving the targets. And so when we look at the performance information, so we could still even be 100% meeting all the performance targets, but still be able to have under expenditure, or the other way around, whereby you can spend 100% but not be able to meet your performance target. And because what is being measured, I guess, would be here, in terms of service delivery through the predetermined objectives and performance information, which targets are being set based on strategic goals. Whereas when we then look at the expenditure, it then talks to the financial aspect of the programs that we have. And so therefore there might not be a cause and effect or a direct correlation to say these two are linked, and so it's just providing clarity on that you would have sometimes divergent targets where you could be meeting high, but the expenditure might be different. Though conceptually, it should be linked that when you're actually spending, you should be able to have high performance. But because of the way that the targets are set, it's not necessarily correlated positively. And so that's the clarity one. And then when it comes to the questions on boards and governance, it's a very important kind of oversight that the department has to play. And there's been quite a number of issues in terms of some of the governance that we have seen with some of the entities. And part of this overall exercise is to look at the white paper, to be able to also look at how to rationalize the entities in order to make sure that there is value for money. And sometimes there might be duplication. So the exercise needs to be taken to be able to, as we determine the overall principles that should govern the entities as contained in the white papers, there definitely would need to be rationalization. That will then also deal with some of the governance issues. So in terms of the terms of the board, that's one issue that we are always looking at as the department in terms of being able to make sure that there's governing boards in place. And there sometimes is a lag between the appointment of the new boards and the selection processes that is taken to get the people with the appropriate skills that talk to the needs of the entity. And so in those instances, there would be an extension of the terms to allow that process for the appointment of the new board in order to avoid having non-mandated kind of councils. So the minister is going through that process and making sure that the vacancies and the processes of appointing board members is taken care of. But the bigger exercise is we are prioritizing the conclusion of the white paper. That will then be able to provide more certainty from a policy perspective to make sure that these boards can be able to deliver value for money. And part of these would be looking at the policies. So Honorable Mahlangu has rightly pointed that some of the issues we're dealing with are relating to the 20% of the budget. But what we do need to do is to be able to have consistent and coherent policy frameworks that can be applied at the different entities to ensure that they are able to, for example, have uniform supply chain management processes that talk from a unified perspective from the department cascading down, and be able to also have the monitoring and evaluation ability to actually make sure that they are able to deliver. And then also be able to have a governance policy in terms of how do board decisions get made, how do making sure that there's audit committees, internal audit, and there are entities, for example, that are not big enough to, because their budget would not allow them to be able to cover internal audit. So part of the white paper would be to look at shared service whereby we could have a shared audit committee or shared internal audit. So that's part of the process of re-looking at the governance of these boards. We know that there's not enough finances, and when you look at the budget of the entities, you might find that quite a considerable amount is being spent on compensation rather than necessarily on the programs that should be reaching our people. And so therefore, we then need to be able to come up with the principles on increasing more programming rather than spending it on fixed costs that do not result in service delivery. So the white paper process will be helping us to be able to rationalize and make sure that there's effective governance. So in terms of pressure and time frames, we are looking at being able to conclude this before the end of the financial year 2015, at least the white paper to be tabled in the cabinet, so that we can then be able to come up with those governance principles that will then talk to the duration and tenure of the board members, the kind of diversity in terms of leadership capacity to be able to lead this board. And then they will also talk to shareholder compacts, because we have APPs, and you need to be able to then, out of these APPs, what is the mandate of these entities to contribute towards meeting of these APPs, and then having the shareholder compact processes tightened up to ensure that we keep the board accountable, the way you keep us accountable as a portfolio committee. So that needs to cascade down and make sure that there's also that consequence management. And perhaps when we go to the issue of the geographical names and the flags, Mr. Ndiman.
Chair, before. On this board of these entities, there was a situation at Pensal Chair where that entity was left without a board for a very long time, and everything in it. Can you assure this committee that what happened at Pensal would not happen, where that entity does not have a board? Pensal has just had a board just recently. And can you assure that by what you are, the time that you are saying, all the entities that currently, because most boards have expired by the month end of September, will have those boards? So that we don't come here and say this is what has happened because there was no executive authority in that particular entity.
To add to that, I don't know how government officials work, because we know that when a board is in place, it's in place for so many years. We know it's last year, that this year in September, the time is expiring for Board A. But we leave it until the very last minute. I don't know whether it's by default or by design that these things happen. We leave it until the very last minute. And it creates a vacuum, and nature does not allow a vacuum. So I think it's very important for the department to take this thing seriously. I talk from experience. You know? I'm talking from experience that officials will leave it until the very last minute. And it takes time for you to advertise for nominations, for having the nominations, going through them, interviews, and all that stuff. But you need time for that. And officials ignore that totally. So I think it's important, what is being raised is important. That we, because if these entities falter, it means 80% of your budget is gone. Yeah? 80% of the budget is fruitless. So it's important for the department to ensure that the entities are set up in a manner that's going to ensure that they deliver on their mandate. And in our strategy planning session, I'll always repeat that it's a pity that you were not there. You would come up educated in that state, ABET for Mahal. You would not pay a cent, but you'd come up with a lot of information. Because they were saying that there is someone that we had invited. That was, they were being straight and honest. You know, and I think you get a lot from people who don't want anything from you, but are out there and honest and saying it as it is. Because they were saying, I quote, the composition of council is worrisome because we take people who don't know anything about this thing that they are being charged with, this responsibility that they are being charged with. That's what that person was saying. We take just anybody and put them there. They don't even know what TENSALT is about and what TENSALT needs to do and how critical TENSALT is to the society of South Africa. Take that person, put them, and that person would need that. I'm just making an example of TENSALT. I'm just making an example. So they were saying it's worrisome because we take people who don't have a clue on what they are supposed to do, and we put them at the helm of this organization and look at the result. So as the department, you would have got a lot of information from that, and you would have gained insight on what is really happening in your museum, in your heritage area, in all those areas that we're being educated in. Tinasa from a lot of education.
I just wanted to know, in terms of concept of law, where do they report in terms of directorate in the department, or which directorate is doing oversight or dealing with them? I knew I wanted to know the department well. We are having plus minus, is it 26 balls or what? They fall under which directorate? Whether it's finance.
Institutional and governance directorate.
Also, is the one that is failing us. Okay. No, thank you. I just wanted to know where we must allocate it, that maybe hitting on the CFO. Unfortunately, somebody maybe need to take blame. We just wanted to know. I just wanted to know where to take fall.
We have not met in terms of the quarterly targets for the board and have reported in terms of those that expire at the end of September. And so we are in the process of ensuring that the appointment process is expedited to make sure that we are on track. Going forward, and Chairperson, you've mentioned quite correctly in terms of these things we should be able to plan for, being able to say these are the terms in terms of the expiry, and therefore start the process running in terms of being able to get the appointment. And so we are in the process of making sure that we get a good picture of the expiry dates and be able to then have processes with deadlines that kickstart saying, on average, it will take us so much time to be able to get through the call for nominations, the sifting through of the CVs, and being able to then get through the interview process and then table the shortlist for the minister to be able to approve. So we're cognizant of the weaknesses that are currently in place, and we are putting measures in place to make sure that the process is adhered to.
I think in all that, you need to ensure that the minister has his pulse on this. You have whatever you may have in the minister's office that gives him the idea. Because ministers are talking around to look at it, hey, what's the minister? What? Because the officials didn't inform the minister. There should be something that shows the minister, maybe a click of a button to look at it and just for the minister say, okay, so and so is expiring during this period. So, hey, has the process started? You know? Because I think it's important for the minister not to find himself in trouble when it comes to this, because this is very important. And if you are saying the awards that are expiring end of September, we are mid-September now, we are in mid-September. Mm-hmm. It's October already. It's October, mid-October already. How far are you with calling for nominations and the process? How far is the process for those that have already expired? And have they been given extension if they need? Because you need to write a letter to say, we are extending your period because of this, that, and that. And I think we need to, as a committee, we need to know if that has happened. How far are you?
Thank you, Chairperson. The department advertised for a number of boards a couple of months ago, and we went through the process of nomination and an interview process to also, obviously, meet the candidates face-to-face. Those processes have been concluded, and so we are expecting the imminent appointment of those boards. We have not extended any of the current boards at this point, but so there is a small interregnum, but we do see that in the next couple of weeks we hope that the new boards will be appointed and be in place. Thank you.
Chairperson, I think as this committee we need to get the report of all those entities in terms of the timelines, which are the ones that are due for the new board. And maybe to check the issue of the independence in the independence trustees that maybe you are roping in terms of the skills. Who are those people? So that maybe we interrogate the report. It will tell us whether this is what we wanted to be such as this committee. Because we talk about the issue of the capacity. So let's check who are those ones that are independent that bring in the skills inside.
So for clarity, it's saying from the people that are proposed to be appointed, who would be meeting the criteria of being an independent director? Okay.
But then I think we are fortunate because I did hear that the acting DG is from PIC, if I'm right. So, if I'm right, are you from PIC? I mean, so the issues of the board, PIC is a very highly standardized entity that know in terms of dealing with it. So the skills is going to assist the department.
Thank you. And I'm hoping that, as you have heard, that in our strategic planning session, the one that term worrisome the composition of the boards and councils is worrisome. I hope you will take that into consideration when you choose people that are to serve in this board. You get people who have an insight, people who have qualifications, people who can deal with the issues within this board, because we want a winning nation, and we can never have a winning nation if we don't have winning entities. So I think it's important that, Monica, as you do your work, you look into that.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Yes, ma'am, I sit as a non-executive director at the PIC and on the audit committee. Yeah. And so can we then be able to go to Mr. Ndima to answer the question raised by Honourable Member Kondo on libraries and also on the geographical names and claim distributions?
Thank you very much, DG Chairperson and Honourable Members. Maybe let me start with the question on libraries, because the question was how much was budgeted for in terms of the infrastructure for libraries 2013-2014. The money that went directly to the infrastructure is 195,368,000. And what was spent is 181,445,000. And then the other question was, how much do we normally pay or per library? Here we're looking at between 8 to 10 million per library. Now the next question was, do you have a standardized design? The answer is no, we don't have a standardized design. There are different designs. In fact, the South African Public Library and Information Services Bill is actually attempting to do that, which is already in motion, to set the norms and standards for libraries. So, and I do acknowledge the fact that the sooner we have a standard design, it will be much more easier to deliver the library and information services, because you're not going to spend a lot of time conceptualizing the design. You would know that there's a standard design, so if the library is to be built, it will just be built without delays. Then there was the questions around geographical names. The question was, what's happening with other provinces? Because there seemed to be a view that says, in terms of the report, KZN is kind of leading. I think the report that we're talking about now is 2009-2014. Honourable Member, if you were to go back and from 2009 backwards, you will see that actually the provinces who did very well, it's Limpopo and Mpumalanga in terms of driving the processes of changing names. So if we were to look 2009 backwards, because they really, really drove those processes, then Mpologwane and all other very important towns within the province were changed. Even Mpumalanga, you had a similar situation. So it's only 2009-2014 that you have this kind of a shift. But it doesn't mean that KZN has been the leading one. It's just a question of the fact that maybe Mpumalanga and Limpopo, they've done much work before. Coming to the issues of flags, we will provide the information that does the breakdown, Honourable Chairperson, where we also highlight the provinces in terms of where, and the names of schools where flags have been provided. But I mean, the key question that the Chairperson asked was, why do we use service providers? My response to this, Chairperson, is that was the way we found more manageable in terms of the procurement of services. Because if you were to go maybe and work direct communities, it becomes a little bit of a problem in terms of the accounting and the procurement processes. That's why we had to go for a process where we said,
each province, let's get two service providers. But also it was an attempt to try and speed up the process because various reports in the previous committee, the issue of flags, just featured prominently, and we were always caught flat-footed because it was very slow. But if one were to just look at the kind of achievements that have been made now, you would notice that we have kind of improved. This year alone, we have done 7,517 flags, which is quite an improvement if you were to compare it with the previous times. But in a nutshell, Chairperson, it was the way of trying to manage the procurement process.
Who are the service providers in the Eastern Cape?
What we could do, Chairperson, because I wouldn't have the information at hand for all the provinces, we could actually provide those particular information.
Okay, I think it's important for all of us as members of the committee to get this information of who is doing this work in our province. So that, because maybe you are not able to monitor the work that they are doing. We'll monitor it for you. We'll come and tell you what those people are doing in our provinces. Because we believe that communities have to have a stake. It can't be something that's done by an individual. And the manner in which they do you have an idea? Or your contract with them, what does it say about the communities and the schools where this is going to be done? Do you have a clause that's binding them to ensure that they use the communities where this, or they import people to go to Kumash and put and install a flag in that high school there and the primary school? So I think give us this information so that we are in a position to see how we can ensure that communities are involved in this, because it's about communities, not about just putting the flag and giving this money. I mean, I've heard a story where I was told that these people come in and dump this flag and dump the books that you give them that have our national symbols. They just dump them. There is no. It should be a community thing. It should be an educational thing. It should be an emotional thing. You know, not just something somebody who comes and dumps this thing and leaves and lets and not even sure that this thing is being done properly. So I think we need to get information so that as these members back in our provinces, we follow it up and come and report to you. Because we are about the people as the portfolio committee. We've said this from the start, that Tina Singabantu, we are here because of the people. And we want to ensure that these services are taken to the people in the right manner. Honorable.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to find out whether you also install flags at early learning centers. You do?
No. Currently, the honorable member, the focus has been flag in every school.
Well, I'm asking this question because if you go in that area of social moving, you'll see almost every early learning center provided with such a flag. So who does the inspection after the installation, whether flags are being installed at the right places?
The responsibility for the monitoring and evaluation of this project is done at the departmental level. Our colleagues in the department, at the Bureau of Heraldry, they are the ones who are following up on seeing to it that work is done properly. And that's why also the kind of information that we are getting here, we'll be sharing with the colleagues so that they strengthen their monitoring capacities around this matter.
Just a comment, because I assume that a lot will still be done by the department going forward. You know, the issue that the chair is raising around utilizing people on the ground. When we think as elites, we tend to think that people can't do or people don't know what they need and how to go about it. But you'll be surprised as to how the notion of elitist faith in real life and a people project wins in comparison. And at a less cost. I mean, we've got, the country has established so many grassroots structures. Talk about your city values that you find in each and every ward. People who know each and every house, every school, every clinic, everything, those people are better able. And they know people on the ground who matter and people who are driven. So they do it to Kasana, I'm a business, we can see the girl and Jana, I'm your father. If you look at the cost, I can tell you now, your cost would be much, much higher than the cost you would have incurred had you followed the other channels that are available. And they are established by the state.
And I think the benefit of using communities, it's not just installation of a flag, but it's educational. It raises the conscience of the people. It reminds them of where we're coming from. It gives them pride. It restores their dignity. So there are a lot of benefits. But if you employ me to go and do this without any condition, you know, because we are saying, if you can't do this, okay, you want to employ consultants, fine. But there should be conditions under which these people must perform this duty that you are giving to them. So that at the end of the day, the community will say, wow, we've done this. Because you install a flag today, you'll find it gone tomorrow. Because people don't identify with this thing that was installed by someone from Gauteng in our province. That was installed by someone from wherever in another province. So I think it's important that, especially as the Department of Arts and Culture, Tina, we can't do things anyhow, because ours is about restoring the dignity. Ours is about creating pride in people. So we can't just do things as other people are doing. We need to ensure that whatever we're doing, it restores the dignity of the people. When we leave the place, the people must be proud of who they are. So I think it's very important, this issue of us working with communities. And also ensuring that provincial departments are involved so that they can do the monitoring, because there's no place called national. Where's this place called national? Do you remember? Where's this place called national? Who stays there? Nobody stays at national. Everybody is in a province. So you need to work with provinces. You need to consult. And you are not asking for a permission. I don't think they want you to ask permission from them, but to consult, to say, this is what we would like to do here. Can we work together? So that as national, when we leave, there are people who are going to monitor and ensure that what was started doesn't just come to an end.
There are just two outstanding matters. One matter that was raised by Honorable Mahlangu in terms of the predetermined objectives. It's true that there were these findings because of the information that was provided. For instance, where we were also caught flat-footed was when we distribution of the handheld flags that we normally distribute during the national days. Sometimes government departments come and request for those whenever they've got functions. The issue of stock registers, where we are able to say the recipient signs off for those flags, and also for whenever we have got national days, find a way of ensuring that there is a stock register that indicates that during this day, flags, so many flags were taken to a particular site. And those are the things that the AG raised quite sharply, because we were as a department satisfied with the information that we have in terms of even showing the pictures. They said no, they're not interested in that, they want tangible information. I think it was the same thing with the exhibitions that we normally have during the national days. We don't normally keep registers. Now we have just learned the hard way that going forward we need to have those registers as people come in commenting and all those. Let's have that information, because the issue of photographs, the AG is not taking that at all. So I just thought that let me just raise those issues. We do concede that there were weaknesses in our systems, but we have since beefed them up. There is an issue, lastly, that was raised by the chairperson about possible duplication between the work that we do and that of the National Heritage Council. I don't know whether it would be a euphemism if I said there could be overlaps rather than duplication, because the Liberation Heritage Route, it's a government process. There is an interministerial committee, and also that reports to cabinet. So at the level of coordination, the central coordination is done at the departmental level. And of course, the National Heritage Council have worked with us in terms of the development of the conceptual framework, the business planning process. They have played a very important role, leading role. But also, they are better positioned than the department to actually engage civil society. That's where they've also done very well in terms of engaging with the civil society. But, of course, the infrastructure projects that are aligned to the Liberation Heritage Route sit in the department. So those are the things that currently you would see that there are overlaps. But, of course, as we just get into this project, we're working towards ensuring that there's clear role clarification going forward, so that it's known exactly what the NHC does and what the department does. I would like to stop there, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members.
There was a question on Freedom Park raised by Honorable Hrodpong.
Okay. All right. Oh, thanks a lot, Acting DG, for that. I'm sorry, I just missed that. Because it was more about, I would speak to the issue of the archives, because that's a The Freedom Park, actually, as part of the master plan of Freedom Park, is the creation of a Pan-African archive, which does not necessarily contradict the work that's happening in the archives, because state archives are not public records, but institutions have got a prerogative to have archives which are more about knowledge production. For instance, the Pan-African archives was going to be more speaking to issues of freedom, what countries, the OAU and all other countries that might have contributed towards the liberation of South Africa. So that was the point. You would see, if you were to go to Lily's Leaf, you would find that they also have their own archives about the Rivonia trials and all those kinds of things. But the work of the archives, the state archives, is to ensure that the public records are actually preserved and protected. So there isn't, there could be linkages and overlaps, but it's very clear what the state archives is supposed to do as opposed to the institutional archives. Thank you.
How do you think the archives, the attention that they deserve? Because I don't think as the department we are giving archives the attention that they deserve. Because I think archives are very important in our society. And I don't, as I'm saying, this is one other thing that is from our strategic planning session, that we need to coerce the department to take archives seriously.
When are we appointing the National Archivist? Looks like we don't have someone there. Maybe the acting DDG for HRM will talk to that, but I must say that there was an advertisement and shortlisting, so I think that the process is more about now setting up the dates for the appointments. So that's as far as I can. I don't know if there's any additional information.
Okay.
to that. Okay, so perhaps you could take that question as well on the accrued leave pay. Okay, so
and then the last part, the question that has been raised by the chairperson, I think it's very important to first and foremost acknowledge the fact that if you were to compare archives to libraries, libraries are more better resourced than the archives. And I just think that it's because also of the deliberate attention that was given to the libraries, which we are now shifting to the archives, because we are now in the process of also looking at the conditional grant for archives. And we do acknowledge the fact that there are still a lot of challenges there, and one way of trying to deal with that is to ensure that we get the conditional grant, because it will then ensure that we cover the infrastructure for the archives. We also cover the whole issue of the human resources within the archives, people who are skilled, because that's one of the things that we have been experiencing over years, that archives actually have become a training ground where people get trained, and then they just get taken by other people, some in the SABC private sector. So I think also as part of this, we would have to look at the incentives so as to ensure that we are able to retain the staff. The levels, the entry levels for the archives, it's one of those areas that we would be looking at as a way of ensuring that you do have a comprehensive plan of ensuring that our archives have got that integrity.
Thank you very much, but I don't think we need to shift something to... We don't need a shift. We just need... Because libraries are very important for our community. Archives are very important. So let's not shift anything. Let's just give archives the attention that they deserve. And also to ensure that the people that... Because it starts from record management. And if the department can get a qualification on market on records, I mean, you are the custodians as this department of records, and you should be leading in records management. So it should not be found anywhere in the department, the issue of not having records management. Wherever in the department should be leading the whole government in records management. And if you are not doing that, I don't know what to say. You should be the ones who are leading in this. You should be the ones who are even giving training to other departments and to municipalities on records management, how you, and the process that leads to archiving. So I think it's important for the department to look at this, and charity begins at home. You need to start within the department to take records management seriously. It's very, very important. And to also get people who are, this bursaries that you are giving, give people who are going to take this profession of archiving. Please, look at that as well. As you give out bursaries for all these other things, look at this area, because I think it is very, very important.
Chairperson, yeah, just actually another issue on the employee assistance, which I also didn't address earlier on, which I can also maybe just refer to, but with regard to the filling of the National Archivist, as Mr. Ndima has indicated, the position was advertised, we've done an initial shortlisting, and I actually as recently as about a week ago or so had a discussion with the acting DG, just saying that we need to finalize the interview. So all of those processes are done, we just need to do the selection of that person. So it's one of those posts that I referred to that before we go on Christmas, we must have a National Archivist in place. Jay, with regard to the accrual of leave, basically in the department, the accrued leave referred to in our statements are those leave days that employees prior to a certain date, and I'm not 100% sure of that particular date, I think it's in 2002 somewhere, where public servants could accrue untaken leave without any limits. So in other words, you'll find a person who's been in service for 30 years who've accrued 200 leave days. And that is then put in our financial statement as accrued leave, which means that by the day that the person retires, that person then gets paid out that leave, and that is why it's stated there. But however, the latest policy in the public services that if you, for instance, given your 22 days credit in a particular financial year, you have 18 months to take that leave, failing which you then forfeit any unused leave. So at least the issue of accumulating accrued leave was stopped when these building up of credits were stopped. With regard to the entities, and because they, all of them fall outside of the public service regulatory framework, being the Public Service Act regulations and collective agreements, they probably have a different type of, and it depends on the policy of that particular entity. And it's maybe more and more we getting requests from our entities for assistance on particularly HR matters, because they've really up to now been responsible for their own employment practices. Some of it at a very high level is maybe regulated by a piece of legislation that governs the establishment and everything, but we are more and more getting requests from our entities to provide them with our policies, with advice and assistance, and I think we've actually taken a decision that we're going to get more involved in as far as that support function is concerned. And that probably, okay, then brings me to the employee assistance. In our department, the DAC, we have an employee wellness unit, which is also responsible for employee assistance program. And although we've not had a service provider for the last couple of months, or actually a year or two, we are appointing one, and that is really your professional social, your psychologists, social workers, those people who it will not make sense for us to employ on a full-time basis, especially because of the size of the department. So we have on an ad hoc basis been referring some of the employees to an employee assistance program. But when it gets to our entities, and I actually had a discussion with the CEO the other day on exactly the same, a matter relating to employee assistance, because of the size of some of our entities, it doesn't make sense for them to assign a dedicated service provider or to employ people specifically. And I'm thinking, I think the NAC has 26, somewhere in the vicinity of 26 employees on their payroll. Now, for them to be employing somebody to be running with the employee assistance program is not necessarily going to make sense on a full-time basis, especially because of the specialized nature of that. And it's maybe something that we can think of moving forward with our entities, is maybe to expand our employee assistance and have it more on a sort of sector-based as opposed to just us as a department on our own.
I don't know. I'm just thinking of a nice way of putting this. The issue of us as government departments working in silos, totally disregarding integration, intergovernmental relations. Because if we have an entity here in Cape Town, for instance, that has 26 employees, what stops us from negotiating with one of the departments that are here, that are having a fully fledged, that have, you know, a big staff complement and are having a fully fledged employee assistance program or whatever you call it? What stops us from doing that? And if there's anything that we need to contribute, then we would be contributing to this, you know, institution that's there, that is doing the work. Why do we want to be in our own corner? It's something that we need to overcome as government departments. Because we like dancing in our own stage. And, you know, I don't think it's we need to change the mindset and to try to look at how we as government can work together. Because why should we go around trying to find a service provider to provide a service for the number of people? Why is there just next door a fully fledged institution that can do this? We must begin to think out of the box as government officials. We must begin to do that. Because I believe strongly that with the money, with the budget that government has, government can transform the society. As soon as sent from anybody else. It's enough. The money we have is enough for us to transform people's lives. But we are doing everything else but transformation of people's lives for the better. I think we need to change the mindset. I know it's not easy, but you have to take a conscious decision. Okay, all right. Okay, this is what I'm going to do. Because when you are used to doing this thing this way, it just happens automatically. This is why you have to take a conscious decision to say, I'm not working in a silo anymore. And when you start, you are like, no, not in a silo. You tell yourself. I think it's important for us to find ways of using the resources that are there. Because we do have resources in government, but we want one for agriculture. They want one for social development. They want one for rural development. Why don't we come together? Especially within the cluster, this cluster, social transformation cluster. We need to find a way of working together. And we need to do that very soon. We need to do it. To find social development, you are in a cluster together. Can't we come? We have this problem. How can you assist us? You know, we need to do this. We need to do this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll note it and definitely try to think outside the box in as much as possible. There's been two questions relating to Engelbert House and also around jobs and cultural development, where 27 were supported, and the question is, have they created the jobs? Monica, can you please take us through?
Thank you. If I use the analogy of a fruit basket to describe the family that is the Department of Arts and Culture, so if the Department of Arts and Culture are oranges and the public entities, the Schedule 3As, are bananas, then Engelbert House is a plum. Okay, it's one of the family, it's a piece of fruit, but it's not exactly the same as everybody else. And there are three exceptions in this case. Blind South Africa, Business Arts South Africa, and Engelbert House are declared in terms of the Cultural Institutions Act, but have been defined as associated institutions precisely because they are so small that for them to take on the weight of the compliance and other responsibilities that are inherent in the Schedule 3A public entities, they would cease to exist. So Engelbert House, Blind South Africa, and Business Arts South Africa are of us, they report to us, they're part of our family, but they aren't necessarily Schedule 3A public entities, which is why the Portfolio Committee doesn't necessarily see reports coming in the same way as the other entities. Obviously, the Portfolio Committee's powers are such that they could certainly invite these institutions to make presentations, but they are non-profits and are essentially guided by the Non-Profit Act, and of course their own ancillary legislation, for example, the Companies Act, where non-profit companies have been created. But so that's the Engelbert House story. It's a very small institution. It's an institution of legacy. In other words, it came with us through the transition. And the only way that we can effectively support them is as an associated institution. With regard to the jobs, certainly in terms of the previous year, we had some real challenges, and these are matters of record in the Portfolio Committee proceedings, with the extent to which we were able to verify those jobs in terms of performance information. So So as we designed the current APP, we broke down the jobs into their component parts. So if you go through the annual report in the performance schedules, you'll see that MGE Cultural Events has job targets, Touring Ventures have job targets, Heritage and Archives have job targets. So altogether, across the annual report, the Department of Arts and Culture has created about 25,000 jobs. This is obviously in support of the much bigger five-year jobs target, so we definitely have some gaps to fill, which we hope over the next 2 years we're going to be able to fill. In terms of the inconsistency that the member highlighted, it's precisely because we're now very careful about how we report on the jobs that we weren't able to include all the jobs that came through from the MGE Cultural Events Program. So where we reported on the exceeded targets in MGE Cultural Events was because projects came through from the open call that we concluded that we weren't necessarily able to factor into the broader jobs data collection process. That collection process involves on-site field visits to projects. It involves three survey instruments being delivered, one for the actual beneficiary, one for any ancillary businesses related to the cultural event, and one for event attendees. That then goes into a quality assurance process, and that's how we report on the MGE jobs. So, in essence, we have supported many more cultural events than we had planned, but unfortunately we're unable to report on all of the jobs data. Some of it because the project started to happen quite late because of the late environment approval, which obviously contributed to the under-expenditure in the MGE program, but also because we were concerned that if the AG asked us to give assurance of those jobs, we would not be able to. So we chose to be quite conservative in the jobs reporting and really only report on those jobs that we could actually prove via a statistical process existed. Thank you.
Thanks, Honourable Member. To address, also there was a suggestion by Honourable Member on when we present the information on comparatives. I think that's quite a useful suggestion to be able to see where we are compared to previous years. So we will note those suggestions.
I think now as a woman, I feel offended. You see the department, when we address honorable members, the main ones, they will quote their surnames to the honorable Matlam, honorable Matlam.
Profound apologies, Honourable Chair. We take a note of Honourable Member Belangulu's suggestions, and also taking Honourable Member Machobeni on the qualified audit. And in conjunction with Honourable Mahlangu, who feel that we are on the slippery road, we qualified, which could lead us to be a disclaimer to an adverse. And it is a valid fear if we had to look at just the Auditor General findings and the current financial statements that have been tabled, and when you look in terms of the entities. However, we would like to give members comfort that we have looked at the situation. You know, Albert Einstein said if he had to solve the problem of the world in 1 hour, he would spend 55 minutes assessing the problem to be able to then the rest of the 5 minutes to come up with the solutions. And so the platforms that are afforded to us by the Portfolio Committee, firstly, in being able to deal with the management letter of the Auditor General, would be a very good platform to be able to cluster. Out of the 180 findings that they have, there's some clusters of root causes that we can be able to identify, and then we can be able to provide how we are dealing with those root causes. So as part of the deliverables, to give the members comfort that we are not on a slippery slope towards an adverse or even a disclaimer opinion, that would be one of the steps. Because ultimately you have to measure us by us being able to fulfill what we promise in terms of our action points. And so that would be a platform that we can be able to utilize. And whether that happens or not, in terms of whether we apply, the Auditor General does test in terms of how have we addressed audit findings that have been raised, and the percentage of those being addressed and the impact thereof. So we welcome that platform to engage with the portfolio committee on that. And then also we hope that then through that we can be able to give some level of comfort or assurance, because what we need to be able to build is lines of defense. And the first line of defense lies here, because you need to be able to, whatever we tell you, whether you ask for the information or not, we should be able to be forthcoming. And so we need to strengthen this line of defense. Then the second line of defense is our risk management, to make sure that our risk management is functioning optimally, to be able to identify the risks before they even occur, so that we can be able to rate these risks and be able to say, with these risks, these are the internal controls that addresses the inherent risk, so that we can then be able to have action which is going to be implemented by this line management, to saying these internal controls are in place. And then there will be those residual risks that then our internal audit as a further added line of defense, to make sure that we've applied appropriately the controls in terms of their design, that they actually address the key issues. And that's why we've engaged with our internal auditor and with that internal audit. When we look at the findings from the Auditor General, to make sure that the solutions that we've come up with as management are really going to be addressing the core causes. And then, of course, they would also test whether those appropriate controls are actually applied. And they would, therefore, through the audit committee, which is another defense, level of defense, to be able to keep us accountable. And then you would have, as the last layer of your defense, then external auditors, who will then be able to give you the assurance that these lines of defenses are working appropriately, and especially in addressing the inherent risk and the core risk areas, which could have pervasive impact not only within the department, but also throughout our entities. And that's a very reiterative process, because there has to be always those checks and balances. And we would be able to then, at the end of that, be able to see how have we been able to meet our commitments. So we welcome the platform to engage and be able to show progress. And where we are failing, we'll be quite honest to say we're failing is because of this reason. But there are mitigating controls that we are going to take because of this and this, in order to make sure that we are able, it's like having a bucket of water. If it has too many holes, you can put too much water there, it's going to keep on flowing. So what we need to do is to make sure that we are able to solidify the holes and make sure that there will not be any further holes that will be coming through the budget. And in that way, we can then be able to allay your fear. But you need to test us on whether we keep our word, and whether these plans that we will be tabling to the portfolio committee would be able to actually stand in terms of our implementation thereof. And hopefully at the end of this current financial year, which is 2014-15, we can be able to stand here and say, we give you that confidence that we've been able to stop that slippery slide down to that and go back to unqualified, and ultimately to go back to the clean audit where there's no findings on the predetermined objectives, no findings on compliance with laws and regulations, and having no findings on the financial statements. That is our plan of action, and we'll be engaging on the platform that you proposed, honourable members.
Thank you very much, Ekundiji. I think you are giving us hope. Honourable member.
Chairperson, I wanted to say that you are giving us hope. It's like we are attending an IMF meeting, you know. You talk about issues of governance, the process, and everything. I so wish you would get that support in the department. So if you will get the good support from your colleagues, whatever, everything that you have just said, you will achieve it. But if you won't get the support, nothing is going to come well. And before we go, even if to the next financial year, because we're having quarterly reports, is the one that after here that will show us whether the 3 months of you, whether you did shake the department or not. But if it's not been shaken in these 3 months, so which is you're not gonna get work done by the clean. So that's the thing. But thanks for the word of faith. There are word of faith for us because the department is just down. I needed that motivation. Yes. We needed that motivation, something to give us an assurance that where we are going from here. So, Pella, we are talking about the annual report, the Bible of the department. So, Chair, hope the next quarterly report, not the annual report, we will get. 3 months is here, I don't know when it's in Jabu. Then when we get it, we'll know that whether there's a new thing or a new face in the department, let's see that. But we needed this hope. And good luck.
You need it. You need it, believe you me. But I think, are you done with the responses? Okay, we thank you for that. And we have said that we need to get a report on entities. I want to, honourable member is saying, I want to get from you members, if we continue with the, okay, let's continue then. You can present the entities. Or just a 5 minute stretch so that we clear our minds before we get into the